It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. French fighter jets slam Islamic State targets in Syria. Massive airstrikes hit the Islamic State stronghold of Raqqa in Syria Sunday, destroying a command post and a training camp. The attack is the biggest so far, targeting the IS group, and comes after the terrorist group claimed responsibility for a series of attacks in Paris that killed more than 130 people on Friday night. President François Hollande called the gun and suicide attacks an act of war. French police have released a photo of a suspect still at large from the attack. The suspect is identified as Salah Abdeslam, a 26-year-old from Brussels, Belgium. The so-called eighth attacker is described as dangerous. President Obama vowed to help France in hunting down the perpetrators of the Paris attacks and said he plans to redouble efforts to eliminate the Islamic State group. Mr. Obama spoke Sunday after meeting with Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan at the start of the G20 summit in Turkey. Flags over the American Capitol flew at half-staff Sunday as a tribute to the victims of Friday's deadly attacks in Paris. Washingtonians also paid their respects at a makeshift memorial in front of the French embassy, leaving flowers and bottles of wine in tribute. Similar scenes took place at French embassies around the world in Istanbul, Berlin, Moscow, and Prague, among others. Among the dead in Paris was at least one American, as well as foreign nationals, coming from at least 13 other countries around the world. A number of people killed were from Muslim countries. They include Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. This is VOA News. The U.S. says that President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin agreed Sunday on the need for a Syrian-led political transition, UN-mediated negotiations, and a ceasefire to end the country's four-year civil war. The two leaders met for 35 minutes on the sidelines of the G20 economic summit in Turkey, the White House calling it a constructive discussion. U.S. officials have often complained that Moscow's bombing campaign in Syria is mostly targeting rebel groups fighting troops loyal to President Bashar al-Assad rather than Islamic State positions. A Ukrainian soldier was killed and eight others wounded in attacks in the country's east as fighting between government forces and pro-Russian separatists intensified despite a ceasefire deal. The shelling took place Sunday near the de facto rebel capital of Donetsk. Egyptian security officials say police discovered the bodies of 15 African migrants found shot to death in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula near the country's border with Israel and Gaza. Another eight migrants were also found wounded. The Associated Press identifies them as Sudanese and says those killed were killed by security forces while they were approaching the wire fence separating Sinai from Israel. The incident occurred south of the town of Rafah. Lebanese security forces are detaining nine people, mostly Syrians, suspected of involvement in planning terrorist attacks, including a twin bombing last week, and smuggling extremists into the country. The Interior Minister announced the arrest Sunday, 3 days after a twin suicide attack in a southern Beirut suburb killed 43 people and wounded more than 200. The United States transferred five Yemeni detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to the United Arab Emirates. The five low-level detainees have been held at the U.S. military prison for more than a decade. None have been charged with a crime. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi, whose National League for Democracy swept into a resounding win in last week's parliamentary elections, opened talks with long-standing military foes as she prepares to form the next government. So far, the NLD's won more than 80% of the seats in the bicameral parliament, a margin that will allow it to choose the country's next president. President Thein Sein promised his full cooperation in the transition to a new government. Philippine authorities preparing for this week's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit completed security simulations and placed the entire country on full alert a day ahead of schedule. A Philippine National Police spokesman said his agency, though, has not monitored any specific or direct threat. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Button, Washington. Today's Monday, November 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's government says it is ready for dialogue with all Burundians in and outside the country.
Let me say that not only that dialogue is going to be based in the spirit of the Arusha Accord, but also, and most importantly, on the Constitution of the Republic of Burundi, which has set up a number of institutions in charge of dialogue.
Alain Yametue is Burundi's foreign minister. A Liberian presidential candidate says President Obama's lifting of sanctions against Liberia is intended to move the country forward. DRC's First Lady offers hope to local farmers, and South Sudan women say they want more representation in the country's upcoming transitional government.
It is very important that all the IO and the government and the other political party to observe the 25% within their representations, make sure that women are involved in all the activities.
Nyaton James Holt is a South Sudan women activist. Uganda's 2016 presidential contenders begin their second week of campaigning this week. We'll hear from former Prime Minister Mbabazi's campaign spokesman. And three Belgian brothers are linked to Friday's terrorist attacks in Paris. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi's government says it is ready for dialogue with all Burundians in and outside the country. Foreign Minister Alain Yamitwe says the talks will not only be in line with UN Security Council Resolution 2248, but also the Arusha Agreement, as well as the Burundian Constitution. This follows calls last week by the United Nations and the African Union for an all-inclusive dialogue amongst Burundian stakeholders under the auspices of the East African Community, mediated by Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. On the other hand, Foreign Minister Nyamitwe says there is no need for UN peacekeeping forces in Burundi because the country's crisis had not reached the level, like, say, the Central African Republic or Mali, to warrant the introduction of UN peacekeepers.
Let me say that not only that dialogue is going to be based in the spirit of the Arusha Accord, but also, and most importantly, on the Constitution of the Republic of Burundi, which has set up a number of institutions in charge of dialogue. Yes, it is correct to say that the dialogue that we have started in Burundi 2 days ago goes in line with those pronouncements made by the United Nations Security Council and also the African Union. But let us work rather in line more with the UN Security Council resolution, because it carries more weight than the communiques of the African Union. And this is not new, because that's exactly how the normative framework is organized in the international arena.
If that is the case, Mr. Minister, it's one thing to say you agree to talk. What are you going to offer? Are you offering a new elections, or are you offering a government of national unity? What are you going to offer?
James, please. I'm talking about the agreement to talk. I'm talking about the readiness of the government to open up dialogue for all Burundians, whether they are inside and outside the country. It is up to the Burundians to know what topics need to come into discussions, not up to me, or not up to even the facilitator. Let's not go into speculations, which might not be confirmed when the dialogue starts.
Would your government welcome United Nations or African Union peacekeepers? For example, some people are suggesting MONUSCO in the Democratic Republic of Congo to come to Burundi.
For what?
Just to make sure the violence stops.
No, come on. We've been over the last 4 days. Could you tell me where you had a violence in Burundi? Could you just give me one instance?
To me that you don't welcome that.
No, me, but for what? Because for the UN to deploy a peacekeeping mission, there's a number of criteria which need to be considered. Burundi is not at the stage of Central African Republic. Burundi is not at the stage, let's say, of Mali a few years back. No, far away from it. You can come to Bujumbura and find out for yourself. Now, MONUSCO, for what I know, its mandate is within the territory of the Democratic Republic of Congo, period. Burundi is not a part of the DRC. However, the resolution talks about contingency planning. But contingency planning does not mean that there is a mission that is going to set feet in Burundi.
Alain Yamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the Belgian capital, Brussels. The three major candidates in Uganda's 2016 presidential election enter this second week of campaigning this week as they continue to make their case to the Ugandan people. Incumbent President Yoweri Museveni of the ruling National Resistance Movement, who is seeking another term after nearly 30 years in power, told voters over the weekend that he will boost universal primary and secondary education if re-elected. He also said he will provide sanitary pads for girls, among other things, to keep girls in school. But Michael Mambike, spokesman for the Go Forward team, the alliance supporting the candidacy of former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi, says Ugandans are yearning for change after 30 years of broken promises by Mr. Museveni, and they are turning to Mr. Mbabazi as the candidate who can deliver the change.
The people of Uganda are yearning for change. And you can see it in their faces. You can see it by the kind of reception and warmth that they give this candidate. The campaign is moving quite well. We are gaining momentum by the day. But what is also very interesting are the massive disruptions from the National Resistance Movement. Every day we receive over 500 leaders and members of the National Resistance Movement. They're coming in to join our candidates. The way we are gaining momentum is certainly sending shivers inside the ruling establishment.
President Museveni used one of his campaign speeches to talk about the declining poll numbers of the ruling National Resistance Movement, blaming it on the disunity within the movement. What do you make of that?
Of course, a regime that has been in power for 30 years cannot be growing in popularity. That regime is on a decline. The regime is suffering diminishing returns. And I think President Museveni himself can see it by the reception that he is getting from the population. It is true that because of so many broken promises, because of biting poverty in the countryside, because of the growing unemployment and failure to resolve it, the people are going to have lost confidence in the NRM, and they are turning up in large numbers to make a statement that we are tired of the regime, a 30-year regime.
In the same speech I mentioned, President Museveni touted the accomplishments of his government. Particularly, he mentioned creating about 2.5 million jobs. So the president is saying that his government has been doing something for the people of Uganda. Therefore, he should continue in power.
No, I think he just does not get it right. One of the biggest failures of the Museveni regime is failure to create and plan for employment. He cannot be a champion of employment because he himself has destroyed all those avenues which can create employment for young people, which can create employment for adults.
Michael, the criticism against your candidate, the Honorable Mbabazi, is that his critics say they don't know exactly what he stands for. Is he a clone of the National Resistance Movement?
That's a misconception. The right Honorable Amama Mbabazi stands for peaceful change of government. Honorable Mbabazi has come out very clearly and said he stands for reforms in our agriculture sector, reforms in our public service sector, reforms in the education sector, reforms in the health sector, reforms in transport and infrastructure. It is a clear campaign. The people of Uganda are receiving it very well, and the people of Uganda are convinced that he is actually the candidate who can win them government.
Michael Mambike is the spokesman for the Go Forward team, the alliance supporting the candidacy of former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi. He was speaking with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Today is Monday, the 16th day of November, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. Most people in eastern Congo would agree that land disputes are one of the root causes of the region's conflicts. Recently, there's been a trend for large landowners to let out more of their concessions to smallholder farmers to cultivate. Is this the solution to the land problem? Nick Long visited one of these concessions owned by President Joseph Kabila's wife to investigate.
Three times a week, a group of smallholder farmers works together on a community field in the village of Kiraliwe in eastern Congo's North Kivu province. Last week, the group was tilling the soil with hoes before planting potatoes. The team leader shouts, "Let's go," while group members tell one another to work harder. An organisation called FOPAC is teaching this group better farming techniques, like sowing improved seed in straight-line furrows, removing grass instead of burying it, and using manure as fertiliser. Mumbere Makuke works for FOPAC as a farming advisor. He tells VOA the surrounding hills are owned by First Lady Olive Lembe, wife of DRC President Joseph Kabila. Much of the land used to be cultivated, he says, but the person Olive Lembe bought the property from last year had turned it into pasture. Lembe is now encouraging smallholders to grow crops on some of her land, which she has renamed Hope Farm. Many local people have little access to land because much of it was bought by ranchers, often on dubious terms. Hope Farm charges standard rents, and these have risen steeply in recent years.
For example, pour un hectare,
Mumbere says the typical rent in this area for 1 hectare, 10,000 square metres, is $200 for a season of 4 months. Many people rent smaller fields of about 400 square metres for $10 a season. FOPAC tries to avoid conflict with ranchers whose cattle often graze farmers' crops. We decided to dig ditches around the field, says Mumbere, to stop cattle getting across. Farmers VOA spoke to here seemed happy with the new farming methods, but there is little manure available for their own fields, and improved potato seeds are $1,600 for the 2 tons needed for a hectare. Joseph Musanza, an agricultural researcher, says many farmers cannot afford to pay any rent, let alone buy tons of improved seeds.
Il y a aussi une autre forme qui se fait, par exemple, ce que je vis au niveau des Ntamugenga.
He says those farmers can have access to land on condition of giving a share of their harvest, often 20%, to the landowner or manager. But as improved farming methods take hold, landowners may not be content with a 20% share of what is likely to be a poor harvest. Unless the government introduces policies to help smallholder farmers, they will have less and less access to land in this area, except as landless labourers, as people with money outbid them. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
One of the candidates in Liberia's 2017 presidential election who had been affected by U.S. sanctions says since 2003 says he's thankful to President Barack Obama for lifting the sanctions. Businessman Benoni Ure, a former associate of former President Charles Taylor, said he's most grateful to President Obama, not for himself, but for other Liberians, some of whom have been sick but could not travel abroad to get treatment because of the sanctions. Ure was sanctioned by the United Nations in 2000 for his alleged role in arms procurement for Charles Taylor's rebels. He denies any role in arms procurement, saying the UN investigated the matter for 15 years and found no magnitude.
I want to thank President Obama for giving Liberia another chance. You know, it's not about Benoni and James Wattie. They're Liberians. The Deputy Minister of Finance, Juanita New, she's been sick, suffering from cancer for almost 10 years, and she has been refused a visa to go to America. Hopefully, she will get one in a few days, and maybe her life can be saved. I hope some congressmen, some people in America listen to me. Forget about Benoni. Look at all of those that died because they were on sanctions. Jenkins Dunbar, Maurice Cooper, all of these people died because they were on sanctions. But thank God, President Obama has lifted it.
So, Mr. Ure, you said that you believe you should not have been sanctioned in the first place. But when those sanctions were imposed in 2002, I think the allegations were that you were the one responsible for buying weapons for Charles Taylor.
James Wattie, the UN have investigated it for almost 15 years. And they found out there's no magnitude there. James Wattie, why would Benoni Ure, a peace-loving citizen of Liberia, who has never really been involved in war, why would I get involved in purchasing arms and ammunition? I made it clear, and for the record, I would like to say it again. I was giving an order from the finance minister. He said the president of Liberia had directed him to instruct me to transfer $620,000. I just wrote a letter to my controller, and I said, by orders of the president as communicated to me through the finance minister, you are hereby instructed to instruct our agents to transfer the money. Where did I go wrong, James Wattie? For me to be held liable,
The last time we talked, I asked you for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommendation. I think their recommendation was that you should be prosecuted for the commission of economic crimes.
If it can be proven that I committed economic crime, I should be prosecuted. But look, let me tell you what the case was. There was a guy whose name is Peters. I think John Peters. He doesn't exist because somebody from the commission admitted to me that he doesn't exist. These are some of the frauds within the commission report. He claims that I shipped 100 containers of rubber out of Liberia. The capacity of the little rubber factory I operated in Banga in 5 years could never ship 100 containers of rubber out. So, you know, that was far-fetched. These are some of the misinformation and propaganda that people continue to spread. But we believe that the American government has investigated it, and they have found no magnitude in it.
Businessman Benoni Ure is a candidate in Liberia's 2017 presidential election. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Women rights activists in South Sudan say they want more women appointed as ministers in the country's upcoming transitional government of national unity than stipulated in the peace agreement. The agreement says 9 female ministers shall be appointed from both the government and the armed opposition, but activists say that's less than the current constitution provides for. Philip Tong Alain has more for VOA from Juba.
Nyan Ton, James Host, presented a paper on the role of women in peace building during a public lecture organized by the SAD Institute. She says women played a key role during the peace talks and must be actively involved in the peace deal. Host says the agreement specifies the number of women to be appointed to the national government, but says nothing about how many women should be appointed to state governments.
It's very important that all the IO and the government and the other political party to observe the 25% within their representations, make sure that women are involved in all the activities.
Who says military commanders are not the only ones who should be given prominent positions in the transitional government of national unity.
Women doesn't have to be at the front line to fight, but women are key stakeholders within the conflict. Women take different roles. Definitely, there are women that we can say that they're actually on the front line.
Woman activist Margaret Matiang agrees. She says the transitional government will have 9 female ministers, including 4 to be nominated by the government and 3 by the SPLM-IO. She points out that that number is lower than the 25% female representation in all government institutions as provided for in 2011 transitional constitution.
When a South Sudanese woman see a woman in a position of decision-making, she always feel proud that she's represented, and she can easily bring her issues to, reach out to that person who is in that responsibility so that her views can be heard.
Matiang says the role of women will be particularly important for peace building in a post-conflict South Sudan.
When people started fighting, many women thought this is a war between, you know, the elephants. But the people who suffered most are women and children. So peace is a public demand, especially for women and children.
Agulde Chute, another women rights activist attending the lecture, says women should not limit their scope to political participation. Chute says the peace agreement is an opportunity to address issues affecting women in villages. Chute says women groups must expand their outreach and fight cultural norms that prevent girls from going to school, such as early child marriages. For VOA News, I am Philip Tona Leo in Juba.
Flags flew at half-staff and thousands of people gathered across France to pay homage to the victims of Friday's terrorist attacks in Paris. Lisa Bryan has more for VOA from Paris.
Three brothers are believed to be among the suspects linked to the string of near simultaneous attacks across Paris on Friday night. Authorities have identified one of them as Abdeslam Salah, born in Brussels, Belgium. The so-called eighth attacker, he is on the loose. French police have issued his picture in hopes that someone will recognize him, but they caution he is dangerous and no one should intervene on their own. Another brother, Ibrahim Salah, blew himself up at the Bataclan Music Hall during an attack there that killed more than 80 people. Belgium authorities are detaining the third brother. Police in both France and Belgium have made several arrests and are also questioning family members and other people linked to the other suspected assailants. French news reports say three French suicide bombers have been identified. They also report that two cars believed to be used by the assailants have also been found, carrying Belgium license plates. More details about Friday's bloodbath have also emerged. Three teams of terrorists reportedly carried out the string of attacks around Paris. One group blew themselves up outside a soccer stadium, killing one person. The other two carried out attacks on several Paris night spots. France is marking 3 days of mourning for the victims, who include more than 350 wounded. Hundreds of people packed Notre-Dame Cathedral for an evening mass. A huge crowd carrying candles also gathered Sunday night at the Place de la République, scene of massive peace demonstrations after January's Paris attacks.
That's VOA's Lisa Bryant reporting from Paris. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoman reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with the rugby. Kenya edged Zimbabwe 21-17 to win the Rugby Africa Men's Sevens Championships in Johannesburg, South Africa on Sunday. Morocco outwitted Tunisia 19-12 to place third. They are followed by Namibia, Madagascar, Uganda, Nigeria, Botswana, Mauritius, Senegal and Zambia in that order. Consequently, Kenya joined South Africa in qualifying for the men's rugby contest at the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil, while Zimbabwe, Morocco and Tunisia get a last chance to qualify for the Olympics at a tournament next June. Turning to football, Uganda outclassed Togo 3-0 in the return leg of their second round Africa 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Kampala on Sunday. Uganda prevailed on a 4-0 aggregate. Zambia beat Sudan 2-0 to progress on a 3-0 advantage. Guinea dismissed Namibia 2-0 to win on a 3-0 aggregate. The Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi drew 2-2. The Congolese go ahead on a 5-4 advantage. Equatorial Guinea pipped Morocco 1-0. However, Morocco advanced on a 2-1 aggregate. Gabon pipped Mozambique 4-3 in a post-match penalty shootout after they tied 1-1 on aggregate. Early on Saturday, Algeria and Tanzania drew 2-2. Republic of Congo pipped Ethiopia 4-3. Botswana edged Mali 2-1 and Chad pipped Egypt 1-0. On Friday, Swaziland and Nigeria drew 0-0, as did Comoro Islands and Ghana. Madagascar and Senegal drew 2-2. Libya edged Rwanda 1-0. Tunisia pipped Mauritania 2-1. South Africa beat Angola 3-1. Kenya edged Cape Verde Islands 1-0. Cameroon outclassed Niger 3-0. And Ivory Coast pipped Liberia 1-0. In Egypt, hosts Rwanda is drawn with Gabon, Morocco, and Ivory Coast in Group A for the Orange African Nations Championships, the Confederation of African Football disclosed. According to the draws conducted in Cairo on Sunday, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, Cameroon, and Ethiopia are in Group B. Group C consists of Tunisia, Nigeria, Niger, and Guinea. Group D features Zimbabwe, Mali, Uganda, and Zambia. The three-week contest starts on the 16th of January in Kigali. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Egyptian police said the bodies of 15 African migrants were found shot dead in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula near the country's border with Israel. That's it for this Monday, November 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will make this week a very, very productive one.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, exceptional future leaders will gather for this year's World Bank's Youth Summit to tell the story of young people's role in the fight against climate change. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests discussing how youth can inspire communities everywhere to take action. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.